Welcome to Sip to Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. Given we're coming up on December and the end of the Brexit transition period, that is what today's episode is going to focus on. We've got a great lineup of speakers waiting for you today, including Sip for CEO Rob Whiteman and Professor Colin Talbot, Professor Emeritus from the University of Manchester. However, given everything that's been going on in the news this week, it would be remiss of us not to touch first upon this week's spending review. So up first, I was joined by Karen Sanderson to look at the headlines for the public sector. So I'm here with Karen Sanderson from SIPFA. Karen has been on the podcast before working on our IFR for MPO project, but she has since joined SIPFA in a slightly different role. So Karen, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you're up to these days?
Thanks very much, Ashley. You're absolutely right. I have changed role. I'm still working on the IFR for MPO project, but I'm now leading a team in SIPFA that is looking after our accounting standards for local government and is looking at our thought leadership and the issues facing the public sector, both here in the UK and internationally, and how we can contribute to the discussion to improve public sector financial management globally. So it's a very exciting time to be in SIPFA. There's a lot going on in the world of public finance.
There is indeed. And obviously we're recording this the morning after the government spending review, which is what we're here to talk about. So Karen, could you give our listeners an overview of what the headlines were for the public sector?
It feels like there were so many headlines actually in yesterday's spending review. Some things good, some things not so good. Clearly there was a lot of money and packages to support the response to COVID-19. And so it's good to see the government still supporting those short-term needs. But it is short-term. It's only 1 year. And so that may not be sufficient to deal with all the challenges ahead. Great to see the national infrastructure strategy and the proposals to spend money on infrastructure. And one of our concerns, obviously, is that what is happening with infrastructure is supporting the green agenda, our move to net zero. So there were some themes in there that were supportive of that. But there's also lots of things like building roads, which may not lead to quite the outcomes that we think that the government was planning. And clearly that will need to be tracked over time. The other really interesting thing for SIPFA, particularly given our support for place-based thinking about where money is spent and how outcomes are delivered, is the announcement of the fund to support levelling up. So $4 billion announced for that. There's pluses and minuses to that. Great to see the money on the table. Great to see that it's place-based, but it's a bidding process. And whenever you have a bidding process, there's always concerns about whether everyone has equal access to that in terms of capability and capacity to put through really strong cases. We noted as well, of course, that the Green Book was reissued yesterday, trying to support this levelling up agenda, which we really welcome. And the focus is moving away from cost-benefit ratios and to looking at what are the outcomes that are being achieved, and particularly in local communities. The foundations have improved. I think the acid test will be, though, is whether that converts everywhere, or whether, because of the process that we're going through, we end up entrenching the divides that are there because the fittest and strongest get more access to funds. That's something that we'll be really interested to see how that plays out.
Great. Thanks, Karen. That was quite a whistle-stop tour of what was a fairly mixed bag spending review. So you touched there briefly on the levelling up agenda and the funding that's been put into infrastructure. The National Infrastructure Plan allocated £100 billion to projects across all kinds of infrastructure nationwide. You also touched on the fact that the Green Book has been reissued with more of a focus on place-based thinking when it comes to how funding is allocated. So how do you think the levelling up agenda, the levelling up fund, the National Infrastructure Plan, how do you think the interplay between that and the revisions to the Green Book are going to play out as far as the levelling up agenda is concerned? How extensive do you think the risk of further entrenching economic inequality is? Or do you think this is a good enabling step in the right direction and shows a positive direction of travel?
I think it's absolutely a positive step with the changes to the Green Book. It creates a framework that is enabling for all of those who are investing across the UK. My concern is around whether in reality, there will be equal access to the funds that are there because there's going to be differing levels of capacity and capability to produce the kinds of business cases that the government will be understandably looking for to make sure that that money is spent wisely. That runs the risk of kind of entrenching the inequalities that are there. So those parts of the public sector that have got strong capability and strong resources may be better positioned to take advantage. The other side is that there may be a risk that we don't make best value for money decisions out of this, and it's a real tension and tightrope that needs to be walked. I think the levelling up funds that have been made available are only for the lifetime of the forecast, and so there's going to be pressure to move this along quickly, and I think it's right, we do need to move quickly, we should have pace in what we're doing, but we also need to make sure that we keep strong financial management running throughout this.
So I suppose to finish up, you touched earlier on the fact that this was just a one-year spending review, and we can understand why that was, given the need to respond to some of the short-term requirements of the present crisis we find ourselves in. But SIPFA has always been clear that multi-year settlements are the most sensible way of managing public money. So moving forward, so maybe looking forward to next year's budget or looking forward to the next spending review, which hopefully will take a three-year planning horizon rather than another consecutive single-year spending review. What do you think the public sector is going to need from the government moving forwards in order to recover our economic position most effectively?
Ashley, you raise a really good point there. And I think, you know, having 2 years of single-year spending reviews is very challenging for the public sector because it means that they can't plan for the medium term. And, you know, that means that decision-making may be suboptimal because different bodies have to plan on what they know. And if they don't know something, they have to make assumptions about what that might look like. So you're absolutely right. We strongly support multi-year settlements to provide that longer frame. And really that sits kind of at the heart of what needs to happen ahead of the next, hopefully, comprehensive spending review. The other things that need to feed into that are things that I suspect government hasn't had the capacity to do in this spending review is thinking about reform. There hasn't been any reform really reflected in this spending review. And there is a great need both in social care and local government to do something differently, to recognise the pressures on services that are there, the funding that is available, and the most effective, efficient and economic way to deliver public services. I've identified a couple of things there that sort of are top of mind for myself in terms of the spending review that was announced yesterday. But it was a really full set of announcements covering many parts of the economy, which obviously has got a fairly bleak outlook going forward, and many other announcements that are part of that. And those are things that we're going to follow up in the coming weeks, and we'll have more to say about.
Great. Thank you, Karen. For all our listeners out there who are interested to read more about SIPFA's response to the spending review, there'll be links in the description bar below. Karen, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen, for that whistle-stop tour of this week's spending review. Now on to Brexit and over to my colleague Kate Latimer, who joined SIPFA CEO Rob Whiteman to discuss the impact of Brexit on the public sector and the economy after the transition period.
So I'm joined today by Rob Whiteman, CEO of SIPFA, to discuss Brexit and the impact that a possible no-deal Brexit will have on the UK. So with a no-deal Brexit looking ever more likely, what do you think is going to be the biggest challenges that the public sector will have to face?
It will be difficult territory for the economy, and that will have a big impact on the public sector. And then there are specific issues about policy and regulation and services, the things that the public sector does that would be affected by a no deal. So just to start with that first bit about the economy, this would be the first time since long before we joined the EU that we won't have had a trade deal with European trading partners. And so that will, of course, have unintended and difficult consequences on the economy. The area of the economy that would be most impacted by not having these trading arrangements in place will be manufacturing. I don't think that will be immediate, but parts of the country that we rely on just in time sourcing and are frequently buying and selling components and finished goods with Europe as their primary market, over a period of time, manufacturing could be the most adversely affected part of the economy as people move towards new supply chains or go out of business because their operating model of how quickly they can produce goods has changed so adversely. Now, obviously, we also read in the media that there's possible impacts on fresh food. I suspect they will be more easily dealt with because they're sort of very visible and people will have to adjust to perishable goods very quickly. I think the long-term implication for the economy is probably around manufacturing. I think there are some issues around financial services, but whilst the City of London will take a little bit of a hit, it's not going to be severe, and the City of London will survive and financial services will survive. So the economy being hit in that way will have a big impact on public services. If it is manufacturing that's most affected, then obviously parts of the country that have a stronger base of manufacturing in their local economies, the public services that serve them, not least local authorities, will have a range of issues to deal with in terms of supporting communities through economic difficulty. I think that will be tough. I also think there's a lot of politics in that because the what are referred to as the red wall seats, and we now see, you know, groups of Conservative Northern MPs forming a powerful lobby group. I think it's those towns and traditional what were Labour areas and the Conservatives have now taken seats there. I think they are very rich in manufacturing, and so if during the course of this parliament, in 2 or 3 or 4 years' time, we start to see that they're the areas most adversely affected economically by no trade, by not having a trade deal, I think there's high politics in that. Then, for the public sector, there are obviously big service implications, massive impact on the border, big impact on departments like DWP and HMRC. So I think there will be public services that will have to gear up to a lot more work that will be generated either by the nature of not having a trade deal or by the fact that the economy goes into some form of regional or sectoral recession. And there will be huge locality impacts as well.
You mentioned manufacturing having an impact on different regional areas. What other aspects do you think will be specifically affecting certain regions?
Different regions are more or less reliant on particular skills that they bring into parts of their economy. So if we will have less supply, or it is going to be a bit more difficult for European labour to come in and out of our economy, and there'll be a transition to the UK economy gearing up on those skills, or still finding ways of attracting skills from the EU, even though we don't have free movement, or attracting a workforce from other parts of the world, that will vary regionally. Sometimes public sector provision is quite dependent on European workers. You think of health or social care in London and the South East, where there are higher rates of European workers. On the other hand, there are some other bits of the economy where people have been quite dependent on European workers for high tech jobs and high skilled jobs in the private sector. So I think you can't give one answer to what's the impact on the economy. You know, an economy relies on having the right people to do the right job with the right tools in order to create the right products and services bit of the equation. And so that's going to vary hugely, and different parts of the country will be affected, determined by the nature of their economy and the nature of their labour market.
Do you think that our changing relationship with international supply chains will affect just the distribution of any future vaccine to the public or PPE?
Hopefully not, but there are some risks here, aren't there? So I think with the vaccine, we seem to be in a position where a number of vaccines are now coming to the point of rollout. although Europe may have bought some vaccines in greater bulk, there are other vaccines that are coming online as well, not least the Oxford one, the AstraZeneca one, where the UK, you know, has a good supply early on. So we must hope that the government has got really good arrangements in place. All that said, I guess the things that I said before apply, and for colleagues on the phone from health or from government or social care, you know, they will be thinking about how is vaccination rolled out, how do we have this mass vaccination program very quickly, how does that happen for the most vulnerable people in care homes in the first instance. And so we're back to the points that I guess we've just been talking about, that does not having a trade deal with the EU affect our supply of PPE, medical equipment and skilled staff to be able to do that? The answer is it doesn't have to. But of course, there are risks that it will. And so I think, you know, this is the classic case of it's a good thing to talk about risks in order that they can be managed and dealt with, rather than risks being seen as mentioning them being seen as negative in some way. Of course, there are risks with not having a trade deal. Let's talk about them and hopefully put contingencies in place to deal with them.
And post-Brexit, what do you think the short-term and the long-term future holds for the UK?
We want the UK to have a good international brand, because that's good for the UK's trading prospects, and to put it bluntly. Yeah, if you think of the accountancy profession, you know, actually the UK has a very strong reputation for professional services and for accountancy. And, you know, if you think of dear little old Sitfa, here we are, you know, 50% of our accountancy trainees are outside of the UK and around the world in global agencies like the UN, because people do think that qualifications that have derived from the UK have international value because the UK's got such a strong brand. Now, clearly, there was a time a decade or two ago where we were Cool Britannia. We couldn't get a foot wrong. You know, we were sort of top of the league table for soft power and our branding. Our professional services, you know, like financial services, our luxury goods, our high-end manufacturing from, you know, Rolls Royces to luxury yachts. You know, the branding of Cool Britannia was a good base for our prospect. What's that going to be now? You know, ideally, the UK isn't seen to have made a mistake. We achieve the types of growth rate that our EU partners are achieving, and it's seen that we are flourishing economically, even though we're no longer in the EU, and that will be good. I think what we don't want to see is that somehow it looks like the UK made a mistake and can't come to terms with it and isn't living with it. It is in everyone's interest, whether we voted Remain or Brexit, for the UK to be seen to be moving on and making a good job of this. And I think it's that point about international reputation, which is probably most important now, actually. And if we look at America at the moment, you know, a very divided nation where, although they've had an election result, clearly half the nation doesn't accept it. We don't want any of that culture war here, do we? I say this as a Remainer. I think that Remainers have accepted that we're not in the EU anymore, but we'd like to see good trading conditions with the rest of the EU. I think there is a risk that we go into this populist phase now where people who voted Brexit somehow feel that Remainers haven't accepted and carry on fighting the Brexit battle, and that we remain a culturally divided nation because of that, and we have that sort of populist trait in our politics. And I just think it would be so damaging for our reputation. So I really hope we can move on.
And what do you think the public sector actually needs from the government at the moment and in the future in order to handle Brexit most effectively and, like you say, try and improve our reputation?
Well, I think there are three things moving forward, aren't there? First of all, regional aid. Clearly, the government has policy to level up and to create a more even economy in terms of economic opportunity, skills and personal income levels. And I don't think that's achievable without regional aid. The risk of, you know, leaving the EU is obviously that regional aid, that has gone in terms of some of the things we did via the EU that we now need to do on our own. The government being really clear about its policies on, are we going to have state aid to help certain industries? Are we going to have regional aid in order to level up? How does that work? Because these are policy objectives that will not be met without regional aid, and we have to respond to the fact that we're not in the EU. Secondly, I think clearly devolution is an issue. Just looking at opinion polling, people in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have a bit more confidence that there is local control over what's happening in their area. And so I think all of this does raise the issues of devolution within England. If 5 million Scots can have a First Minister absolutely determining what's best for Scotland in terms of the COVID response, then why can't 9 million Londoners have something similar? And I don't think we're going to move to a German solution of the Länder and regional parliaments and regional prime ministers, but the central state, that is England, doesn't work. And so I think regional aid linked to devolution and a clear understanding of devolution is probably something that we would all like to see reform on as part of the future. And then finally, the state making a good job of setting its own laws in areas that the UK used to cover. How will we do procurement post-EU? How will we deal with green standards and sustainability? How will we deal with lots of environmental issues like pollution? I mean, these are not, I'm not saying these are bad things. We can now set very clear policy on them. If I think about the language of Brexit, we can legislate more freely rather than in negotiation with European partners. I think we need to make a good job of that. The risk, as I see it, for the UK and for the public sector is it takes us a while to get over the impact of Brexit and the impact of COVID. And so we don't get into the bright, confident upland of being able to deal with things for the medium term and the long term. Public services don't want to be in a crisis. They don't want to be firefighting. They want to be dealing with medium term issues of levelling up and all the other things that we spoke about before. I think the risk for the UK at the moment is just how long do we stay in this period of firefighting and when can we move on? And that's vital for the public sector. I think all I'd finish with saying is, you know, in terms of the COVID response, in terms of the response of how do we tackle a no-deal Brexit as a public finance profession or as a public sector more widely, you know, keep going, folks. You're doing brilliant work and the Institute is there to help you in whatever way we can. And we're proud of the work that the accountancy profession is doing in the public sector.
Great. Thanks very much for joining me today.
You've been listening to Sit for Speaks, and that was Sit for CEO Rob Whiteman. Coming up next, we have Professor Colin Talbot, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Manchester, on the organisational and structural challenges for the British government following the end of the Brexit transition period. So I'm here with Professor Colin Talbot, Professor Emeritus at the University of Manchester. Hello, Colin. Could you please tell us a little bit about your academic background and your areas of study?
Thank you, Ashley. Yeah, I'm, as you said, Emeritus Professor of Government at Manchester. I'm also a research associate at the University of Cambridge. I'm now retired formally, but I'm still doing a lot of work, including looking at changes that are taking place to the British central state as a result of Brexit and many other things that are going on at the moment.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for joining us on our episode about Brexit today, Colin. So just to kick off as sort of a big scene setter, what do you see as the biggest challenges for the UK state following the end of the transition period at the end of next month?
Well, you break it down into four areas of change that I think are going to take place in terms of the sorts of things that government do. One big change area is obviously going to be regulation, where the British state is going to take responsibility solely for regulating things which in the past were shared with the EU. That's going to mean a whole host of regulatory changes, one of which would be interesting to see, which is that in the past, most EU changes in policy that have taken place have been implemented in the UK mainly through statutory instruments, secondary legislation, without necessarily big debates in Parliament. But one thing that may well happen now is that a lot of changes that are going to take place over the next few years will have to almost certainly have to go into primary legislation in Parliament. So that's going to change the relationship quite a lot. The second around that, and it brings me on to the second topic as well, which is that we're going to have to duplicate the functions of a lot of EU regulatory agencies, which we delegated authority to. So we've already seen, for example, the European Medicines Agency, which was based in London, to which we contributed a lot, but it was the regulatory body that would have been, for example, authorising the vaccines that we're currently looking at. We've now had to expand our own individual regulatory agency in that field, and we're going to have to do that in a host of other areas as well. And that brings me on to the second area, which is organisational changes to the British state. The most obvious areas are we're going to have a whole bunch of new or expanded existing regulatory agencies. We're going to have a massively expanded customs function because, for example, the amount of customs checks going on in Dover is going to expand by a factor of about times five because of the changes. Similarly, on migration and border control for people, because now people coming from the European Union are going to have to be checked in a way in which they weren't before, and similar with them leaving. So there's going to be a whole host of organisational changes. One as well, which I think is going to be quite interesting, is who's going to handle relationships with the EU in the future. I mean, at the moment, it's being handled by David Frost and the Cabinet Office, but that's not going to continue after we're actually out, after the transition period and the treaty's been formed. So is it going to be passed to the Foreign Office, which is now massively expanded because it's taken on international development as well? Is it going to be expected to handle European relations or relations with the EU alongside all of those other things? Third area is obviously money. We're already seeing some of the changes taking place, but the sort of regional funding, funding for farming and various other subsidies which came via the European Union, particularly regional funding, is going to be, I think, a critical issue. And the final area, which is something people miss out on quite often, is information flows. One of the things we've benefited from being in the EU is being part of the European Information and Research Networks. And that's hugely informed things like public policy, because we're part of Eurostat, which gives us all sorts of comparative information with other European nations. We're now out of those organisations. It's already the case, those of us who do comparative research, as I do, are finding it increasingly difficult to compare what's going on in the UK with what's going on in other European countries, because we're starting to alter the basis on which we do things and not have the same common framework as we had with the rest of the EU, and we're not being included in Eurostat statistics anymore either. And of course, the final thing in that area is research, which we need to sort out. It's hugely important. We've got massive research interests in space and advanced technology areas with the EU. It's still very unclear exactly how they're going to settle down after we finally left.
So you touched there on the regulatory changes, the changes to the organisation of the British state, all these changes that are going to need to be made. Obviously, the transition period is looming upon us with quite some speed. How prepared do you think the UK is to make these changes?
Not very, I think. Partly because until what the post-transition period arrangements are, it's very difficult to make things like the regulatory arrangements. I mean, I just find it hugely amusing, these adverts they keep putting on the television for industry to get ready. And everybody I talk to an industry says, get ready for what? We don't know what the setup's going to be. We don't know what forms are going to have to be filled in. We don't know what computer systems are going to have to be used. We don't know what tariffs might apply. So, you know, how are we supposed to get ready for it? We're supposed to be employing, I think the figure cited by the government is 50,000 customs agents. They're people who work for the private sector, helping them to fill out the customs forms, but they don't know what the customs forms are going to be. Those people haven't been employed, as far as I can see, and they can't be trained because there's no information about exactly what it is they're going to be doing. So, no, I don't think we're terribly well prepared at all. And some of the things are really worrying as well. I mean, things like the security cooperation with the EU. I mean, the government's made huge emphasis about how we're going to control our borders. One of the things we'd be wanting to do is check to see whether or not EU citizens coming into the UK are criminals or not. But at the moment, unless we've got an agreement, we won't have access to the European databases that will tell us whether or not they're criminals. So we'll have less control over people coming in than we've got at the moment. So no, I think there's going to be all sorts of chaotic areas which will sort themselves out eventually, but we could well have a year or even more in some areas of fairly chaotic things going on until these are settled down. Even if we leave on no deal, a lot of these things will have to be sorted out. So we may end up with multiple individual issue deals, a bit like Switzerland and to some extent Norway, rather than having a single comprehensive arrangement with them.
So you touched there on the nature of the chaos, kind of being different, potentially different in different areas. So do you see the challenges as being fundamentally different, both, I suppose, at a regional level, because you touched on the regional nature of some EU funding earlier, and perhaps across the four nations of the UK, and what all this means for the State of the Union?
Well, the biggest challenge in terms of the four nations of the UK is obviously for Northern Ireland. It's got a big land border with the European Union. There are all sorts of all Ireland of Ireland arrangements in place as a result of some of them predate the Good Friday Agreement, but certainly since the Good Friday Agreement, there's a whole range of things that are agreed across the Ireland of Ireland. And there's going to be massive issues about the relationship between the border between Ireland and the north of Ireland and the border between the north of Ireland and the rest of the UK. And yet again, we don't really know how that's going to work at the moment. And that's going to be enormously problematic for Northern Ireland. And we're already seeing shifts in opinion there. It's quite clear now that there is a increasing sentiment towards reopening the border question and whether or not Ireland should be reunified. And that's quite possible within the next decade. That's going to be on the agenda. As for the rest of the UK, it's obviously accelerated the dynamic towards Scottish independence and change of sentiment there. The other thing is that a lot of the arrangements that existed under the EU for things like regional funding are being re-centralised into into Westminster and Whitehall, and the three devolved assemblies are all jumping up and down about aspects of that and saying that the Internal Markets Bill, for example, takes back a lot of powers away from the regional assemblies back to Whitehall and Westminster, and it's that issue's been underreported and under-discussed because of all the kerfuffle about the bits of the Internal Markets Bill which break the international treaty, and so it's largely been ignored. So yeah, I think there's going to be all sorts of issues, and obviously the dynamics of the economies in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are slightly different to England, and that's going to pose all sorts of problems.
Great, thank you. Let's end on a slightly provocative note. You once wrote, I think it was in one of your blogs, that an attempt by the Johnson government to crash out of the EU against the wishes of Parliament, the law and the courts will not just mean leaving the EU, it will be a massive step towards dethroning democracy in the UK. So I think it'd be really interesting to hear kind of what underpinned this. I think you've touched on a bit of it in your last answer, but do you still think that no deal Brexit poses a risk for UK democracy?
Well, I was writing then in the context of the Johnson government trying to push through proroguing of Parliament and all the other things that were going on a year ago now. It seems like an eternity ago. But so, yeah, some of those things obviously didn't happen. I mean, they got rolled back on the proroguing of Parliament. They got forced into accepting that Parliament had to make the decisions about these things. And of course, since the general election in December last year, they now have a majority in Parliament. So it's not a case that they're defying the will of Parliament anymore, because they've got a majority around this. I think there are, however, other changes taking place which are extremely worrying that the government's trying to implement, and it's very clear. And I mean, this is not there's an interesting piece in The Economist recently saying that it's quite clear what the agenda of the government is in terms of trying to strengthen the role of the executive, which is already, by comparison to most other countries, very powerful in relation to both the courts and Parliament and the legislature. And the government's attempting to do that even further. So they are worrying developments, and there's certain parallels with what Trump was trying to do in America. That's obviously come to a halt now, but in the process there's been quite a lot of damage done to American administration. We've still got the 4 years to go, if you like. The Trump experiment's coming to an end. Unfortunately, we're just at the beginning of the Johnson experiment here.
Brilliant. I think that's a really interesting and slightly ominous note to end on in many ways.
Yeah, it is. Slightly terrifying.
But, I mean, thank you very much for your time.
That's all right.
And where can our listeners find out more about your research?
Well, I'm on Twitter. I have a blog site called Public Interest. I now have a YouTube channel called Public Administration Exchange. I'm easy to track down if you Google me, and just drop me an email if they want to know anything.
Amazing. We'll have more information on all of those sources in the description bar below. And so all that's left to say is thank you very much for your time today, Colin.
Thank you, Ashley. It's most enjoyable. Thanks.
Thank you again to Professor Colin Talbot for his participation in this week's episode, and thank you again to all of our speakers. That's about all we've got time for this week, but please email media@sipfa.org if you have any suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the SIPFA Speaks podcast. We'll see you next time.